Welcome to The Cherry Picker, the horror movie podcast where we like to kill people, but not really. I'm your host, Zach Cherry, and with me, as always...
Spam. Eddie of Edward is True. Was that in your cut?
I don't remember. Okay, well, first of all, hello. We are talking about
Hi.
Dawn of the Dead, released September 1st, 1978. This is the original. And I guess this is coming up on 50 years. No, 45 years. What is with my
Yeah.
Mind? Yeah. Yeah.
Math.
Yeah.
Math.
45 years. And I don't know. I haven't seen this in such a long time that
we're
you know, with the Cherry Picker, we try to have a diverse range of movies, just in terms of like the eras in which things came out. And, you know, we don't always get to a lot of the older things released in the 70s or before that. So I just thought that this was a good title to throw in there, especially because I hadn't seen it in a while. And yeah, you're talking about different cuts. There's apparently like 10 different cuts of this movie.
It's insane.
This is the one I have, which for people listening, I'm holding up the Blu-ray of the Anchor Bay release that came out in 2007. So just to give you an idea, like I probably watched this last in 2007, 2008. And this is like really expensive to find now.
I know. It's because it's out of print and there's no... Okay. I got a soapbox to stand on about this movie for a second because it was so hard to locate it in. I don't mind investing, you know, like giving some money, like $3, $4 for a rental if I don't own it. So, you know, because these movies deserve to make money. I couldn't find this on any platform except YouTube, put up by like independent like content creators, like you, people with just regular YouTube, like, accounts. So you can't even rent it on YouTube. The only version that's omnipresent is 2004, the Zack Snyder, remake.
Oh, that's everywhere.
And so even when I was looking for the Blu-ray after I screened this off YouTube, one of the many cuts that they had available there, I think they have them all available on YouTube. So that's good. I guess, but it should be making money. Like it should be, I'm going to canvas for somebody beat everybody else, like Arrow or Scream Factory or Criterion or whoever wants to, there needs to be a mad dash to be the first people to produce a comprehensive, you know, like binder that is, compatible with your players and mine, because there are there's a really good 4-disc Blu-ray H and I think also 4K box available in Region B coding, but I don't use Region B.
Yeah, it's not in the state. Yeah, it's not in North America. The thing is though that this is one of those movies, like we've talked about this issue before, where some things don't need a high definition upgrade because you really start to see the flaws. And this might be one of those movies that looks better. I mean, like this is pretty crisp on this Blu-ray.
Yeah.
I can imagine. Yeah. And I've heard from people as well that the 4K version is just like, it doesn't look good because, you know, it's, you see all the flaws and imperfections of the makeup and the gore and whatnot. So, I mean, I would never be above getting this on 4K. Like, I think I'll hold on to this for a while because I've had this for a while and just because it is very expensive. Like, I think I saw something was like $100 used for that, which is crazy. But, it's funny that like every time I look up, even if I like Google Dawn of the Dead, the first thing that comes up is actually the 2004 Zack Snyder version. So it's almost like the original has kind of been erased partially, I think, for a lot of people. And I don't want to get too much into the remake. I will say that I don't want to say if I like it better or worse than this one. But I'll say that I have seen it recently and it is a really good remake. And I'm, and to be perfectly honest, I'm just, because I haven't seen Dawn of the Dead 78 in a while, I'm really still working through a lot of my feelings about it. So, you know, we might get to that by the end of the episode, but I'm interested to hear, like, what are your complete thoughts about it? Just, you know, in a nutshell. Yeah.
Just a little background. The first, I didn't grow up with this movie. I was never really a big zombie subgenre fan because it's so bleak. I don't even know if I've I probably expressed that on this pod before, but just so you know, like really, really bleak subgenre. Unless people incorporate comedy into it, and sometimes the comedy is, you know, like larger than life, and that works. And sometimes the comedy is just kind of like wrought out of the situation, like the situation is so tragic you gotta laugh kind of thing. So either way, I appreciate when people make that movie, because the bleak apocalyptic post-apocalyptic, like people turning on each other, or we're, you know, or who are the real monsters, them or like all that shit, like I just as soon watch a slasher movie. So I didn't see this one until I knew the remake was going to be released. And I remember seeing the trailer for that and being very encouraged, wanting to see it. But in preparation, I thought I should see the original, you know, so I have something to compare it to. I don't want to see the remake before I see the classic, especially because I actually really did, when I was a kid, love Night of the Living Dead. So, so I rented this and I watched it, and I remember liking it, but I don't remember. I mean, I did watch a longer cut. I watched the longest cut available. The complete cut is what it's dubbed, and it's 2 hours and about 35 minutes long.
Oh, wow.
And yeah,
this one is 127, so you definitely,
so 2 hours and 7 minutes. And then there's another extended remaster cut that is 2 hours and 19 minutes. Nice happy medium. But I figured may as well watch the whole thing, see what, you know, what George A. Romero put together. So sitting through that, I guess I got a lot more, about, you know, a half hour more at least of footage than I did when I saw it almost 20 years ago. But I did get a lot more out of it. I found it incredibly socially relevant and culturally thought-provoking. I really enjoyed the ride. It didn't feel like 2.5 hours, which in this day and age, when so many movies are 2.5 and 3 and 4 and 5 hours, whatever, and I'm like, no. It was nice to sit through it and actually just kind of like take to the movie and not worry about like how much more time do I have or anything like that. It didn't occur to me. I had a great ride with it. And for somebody who is as behavior-based a moviegoer as I am, with a predilection towards that particular style, that appetite got satiated this time. I was really, really happy watching these people interact with each other for the most part.
So do you like have any recollection of like the regular cut that you had previously watched and like what might have been the additional scenes in this one?
Not really. I have a clue because sometimes there were scenes that would change in resolution. And usually when you see things that are thrown back in, it's a lower resolution. It was higher. All of a sudden the colors were more vivid, and maybe somebody remastered those moments themselves and incorporated them with like the professional remaster of, you know, whatever cut they put together. I'm guessing they probably took the extended remastered cut that was 2 hours and 19 minutes long and took additional deleted material that was never incorporated back into the movie and figured out where it should go. Because also it didn't flow all the time. Sometimes there were very abrupt cuts.
Like visually or narratively?
Both. Like, like all of a sudden you'd be inside with one character and you know that they're escaping outside, but all of a sudden they'd be outside and they'd be escaping. You'd be like, oh, there's no transition there. That's probably something, if they thought they were going to keep it in, they might have shot a transition for that. But it, nothing too jarring, like nothing that was like discombobulating or made it difficult to understand. It was just like, oh, I'm watching, you know,
interesting,
a Frankenstein's monster.
Yeah.
So what about you?
Well, you know, similarly to you, I agree. The zombie subgenre is not one of my favorites. I don't find it particularly fun. And I agree, it's very bleak. That's not to say that there can't be fun here. I find that this one is an exception in the way that it looks aesthetically. I think that, like, really, like, the look and the style and the cinematography is the highlight of this movie for me, because what George Romero was going for, at least like from what I've read, is that he really wanted this to be a comic book style zombie movie, you know, since Night of the Living Dead was black and white and just a completely different thing. And I know that Tom Savini, who did the makeup and special effects, like he looks back on this with, you know, not, I don't want to say disgust, but you know, he clearly is just like, I could have done better work, we'll say. Aww. And I think one of his problems was just the way that the blood looked in this movie. Cause, and the way that he described it specifically, Tom Savini, is that it looks like melted Crayola. Like this is the reddest blood you're ever going to, like, it's like, it literally,
it's looks Argento
like
blood.
It looks like cartoon. Funny that you mentioned Argento too, just because of his influence and involvement. But just hearing Romero say that, like, no, that's what he wanted, because it does give it like this cartoon splash. It's like we're looking at like panels in a comic book of like every scene and every frame that's happening. So in that regard, like, I really love this movie visually and aesthetically and all that. But okay. Just because I hadn't seen it in so long, like, I remember this movie being one of my favorites. Like, I, you know, like, maybe like a five-star movie. And I'm just watching it today and thinking, like, when are we going to get to the meat of this movie? Like, when is something going to happen that interests me? Because I felt that everything felt very much the same. Like, it was just like a lot of action that could have been interchangeable. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it just like wasn't conveyed properly, or I'm just an idiot and not able to pay good enough attention. But I just, the characters were constantly like busying themselves with like doing stuff. And I felt like there wasn't, not that I need exposition to explain things, but I'm just like, well, what are they doing now? Like, what, like, I just, there's so much running around and there wasn't any rhyme or reason. It wasn't until like the quieter moments where they were kind of just sitting still and having conversations that I more so got what I wanted out of the movie, of just like more like the interpersonal relationships and that kind of thing. And in seeing that, I actually realized, like, I don't like anyone in this movie. Like, these are like not likable characters.
Oh my God. okay.
It's interesting because it really, like, Romero had his finger on the pulse of like not only like those times, but of just like where we are today in society. Like when we look at like a global pandemic and how people behave and respond to it, like it's really like startlingly accurate. And I guess that it moved a little too slow for me. And when it did get to the parts that were sped up, it all seemed very vague. Like I can't really remember. Like, that was the good thing. Like, I didn't remember most of the movie or just like how it pieced together. But by the time it all came together, like, I remember that the biker gang came and then like that kind of ruined everything for them. But I just felt like I was watching, again, like what you just described is like how these movies are very bleak about these people, like, you know, trying to find hope in something and, you know, build that up. Yeah. And then like all of a sudden it just gets torn apart and it's just like, well, why did I watch that? You know, just in terms of like socially and all that, like, I do think like the movie looks really neat, but yeah, I just left this and I'm still grappling with it. You know, I'm still trying to figure out how I ultimately feel about Dawn of the Dead.
I have to wonder, because it's interesting we bring up like the remake with Zack Snyder, because I have a similar theory about what happened to this movie. It's not even a theory, it's like a full-on, just, I don't know, I could write a proposal, I don't know what it would be, but an opinion, an observation that I have about Zack Snyder with his DC movies, which I will not, you know, linger on. But I know that, you know, he directed his own Batman v Superman, and the studio didn't let him release it. And then he finally got to releases, and most people thought, okay, this is definitely superior to what the studio did to your movie. And then when they got to see his Justice League, and they were like, oh my gosh, I can actually see how things matter and how, like, you know, the time you're taking and the way you're building character and relationships and relevance and everything. And I got a sense of that that I didn't remember from seeing the theatrical cut. Even though it's only a half hour difference of footage, but I mean, that's still like a long time when you're sitting there watching a movie. And something about spending as much time as I did with those characters, like so it moved even slower. I don't know. It just kind of made the moments, like, you know, you're talking about like the biker gang, like showing up and like, you know, completely like this perversion of justice, like within this, like, kind of like small utopian society that they've created for themselves. All of a sudden there's pandemonium, like the pandemonium we opened the movie with. And it hurt me because I felt like I had sat still with these characters long enough to like all of them. I didn't like all of them right off the bat, but I will say that it took me a long time to warm up to Fran and Steven in particular. But Roger and Peter, Roger even I was a little leery of, like I didn't know what to make of him at first. But with Peter, he was kind of my way into the movie. Like I felt like I love everything that this man is doing. Yeah. I love everything.
I don't dislike these characters. And definitely like Peter, played by Ken Foray, is probably like the one that, you know, I feel at least like the we as an audience are supposed to be most sympathetic towards, and friend to a certain extent. But I just didn't like the strike against him is when they're all sitting there and Fran, they think she's sleeping with a cigarette in her hand, but they think she's sleeping and they're all discussing, like, she looks really sick. Like, you know, like implying like, you know, maybe she's been infected, and Steven says, well, no, she's pregnant. And then Peter says, well, you know, we can abort it if you want. I know how to do that. And almost like just the fact that he brought it up, and then like Steven is sort of like entertaining that. And she's, you know, taking in every word because she's not sleeping. She's got a fucking cigarette in her hand at that point. I think maybe I'm misremembering. But then they start talking about like just staying there. And she's just like, well, I thought we were going to go to Canada. Don't I get a say in this? And like, Jesus, I thought you were asleep. Right. So it's just like, cool. Like all you guys are just like now taking control of like what this woman is going to do with her body, deciding that like, well, we're going to abort the baby for her because that's going to be too much of a liability for us and stuff like that. So, I mean, just like everything about Peter is great, but I just like, it was interesting that he was the character that brought that up, you know?
Yeah. But it's also interesting that affected you in that way, because all I focused on in that particular moment, I didn't single him out, because all I could think was all three of these men are talking about the fate of this woman and the pregnancy that she has going on inside her own body. And they're the ones who are weighing the pros and cons of like, well, should we keep it? What do you want to do? And no one's asking her. No one's including her in on the process. Mm-hmm. So it was much less like a focus on Peter, and it was more just like a focus on the fact that like these three men are having the conversation and no one is suggesting, well, what would she say? What would she think?
No, absolutely. But just the fact that he's the one that brought it up is almost like that's the strike against him.
But what redeems him, and I don't know if you have this in your cut, is that later, pretty soon after that, when Fran starts taking up some space, like vocally to them, saying like, listen, I want you guys to talk. I don't want you to treat me like a den mother, and you're going to talk to me. I'm going to be in on every conversation that you have and every decision that gets made. I get a vote too. And I love that he was the one to respond to her and almost go like toe to toe with her as an equal and be like, all right. Like, and I thought that was cool, because here I saw, again, around the corner, or just, you know, across the other side of her is her husband, or not her husband, her man, Steven, who looks really fed up and really upset that she's doing this. And I'm like, everything she's saying makes total sense. And Peter seems to be the only one who's outwardly showing like, yeah, that's cool. We got it. Now I know that that means something to you. So yeah, I'll treat
you
that
way.
No,
that was definitely in the cut that I watched. It was, from what I recall, he kind of took her side or spoke up for her and just said, no, that makes sense.
Yeah, totally.
And I see that more of just like, cause he's kind of like the most pragmatic character out of everyone in that group. Yeah. So it didn't really feel like, okay, well, this makes sense because, you know, she should be allowed to have her own, like make her own decisions. Like this makes sense because it's like something that will save my life later on down the line. Like if it needs to. So, I mean, like I said, I like these characters. I don't dislike them. I think Steven's probably the worst, you know, if I had to rank them. But I couldn't emotionally get attached to them. Like there was always something lingering over them that just felt not good, you know? Like it's maybe been like 2 years since I've seen the remake. And I don't remember like those characters being necessarily more sympathetic, but I felt that it was a lot easier to understand who they were. Whereas like here, I have a lot of like, it's difficult to find like an entry point for a lot of them. And like the one, is it Roger, the blonde guy?
Yeah.
I don't know what, like if this was an acting choice or direction or whatever, because like he was like cool, calm, and collected for like the first half of the movie, and then he just like goes off the rails and he is like super erratic and reckless, and then you know we know what happens to him. But it's just like, because I was like looking like, okay, like maybe I like him, and then he turned out to be like a psycho.
Okay, that's one thing I wanted to... Okay, let's go into that.
Wait, do you have a premise? We always forget the premise.
Yeah. Before we go into that, let me read the premise.
We're 22 minutes in. Let's get to the premise.
Why not? Yeah.
When the United States is devastated by a mysterious plague that reanimates millions of recently dead human beings as flesh-eating zombies, rural communities and the National Guard prove effective in fighting the zombie hordes in open country areas, but urban centers descend into chaos. After two TV station employees and two police officers set off in a helicopter only to come across a shopping mall, they finally manage to cultivate an environment that, while not zombie-free, proves quite secure from the Dawn of the Dead.
Huh? I'm guessing since you didn't credit anyone that you wrote all of that yourself.
I mean, I got it from the Wikipedia page, and I got the back end of it a little bit from Curly Q Link. Oh, no, wrong. Grants. With two S's,
it's Grant. Okay. I don't need the credits. I'm always curious.
I like to give credit where credit is due. Yeah. All right, so yeah.
Usually
I do that, but I was so discombobulated because we were in mid conversation.
Anyway. We have no structure. I mean, if you're just joining us, 52 episodes into this, that we have no structure to this thing at all. You know, we basically talk, we forget that we talked about something, and then we remember that we had to talk about something, and then we get to the cherry picker.
Yes.
And then at that point, we're just like, oh yeah, we didn't talk about this. So really, we just make it up as we go along.
It just happens. It's a conversation, like real.
Exactly.
So
you said like braille?
But I did. Like real.
Oh, like real. Is it like Braille?
No, like it's a conversation. Like Braille, you know? Like, yeah, that makes a lot more sense. Anyway.
I mean, Braille, if you didn't know how to read it.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Okay. So, Roger, that was a point I actually wanted to ask you, because prior to what you're describing about him kind of like going mad or whatever, yeah. You know, he gets bled on and he kind of freaks out. Did that happen in your cut?
He gets blood in his face a few times. He's like,
yeah, he's killing zombies, they're just like exploding in his face.
Yeah, he's like the Huey from the Boys, like the Jack Quaid, but in Dawn of the Dead, just constantly like every time like there's any sort of altercation, he's always got like blood just running, like it getting inside his orifices. Like, is that?
Right.
Okay, let me ask you this. Sorry, we're taking us off on a tangent. Because, like, this is okay. 1978. Like, I don't think the AIDS pandemic was, like...
A pandemic yet?
Yeah, it wasn't. I don't think so. But it wasn't, like, it wasn't really in the public consciousness at that point.
No,
but, okay.
No.
Yeah, because I was seeing that. I'm just like, okay, is there some sort of commentary on that? Because this feels like it's too early for that, just in terms of the era.
I mean, there are plenty of other diseases that are communicable by, you know, like human liquid, shall we say? You know, like
gross.
You know, like human organic human matter, yeah. Shall we say, that you carry within your fleshy cargo.
Yeah.
So I mean, pandemics had happened before too. So there's all that. That's another point I want to ask you about in terms of like. Symbolism and whatnot. But before we get to that, Roger got bled on profusely in this particular scene. And it's right after, it actually happens right on the heels of when Peter just kind of gives Fran the thumbs up and says, okay, you're going to learn to fly the helicopter then. Cool, whatever. And they all just exit. And that's when Roger gets bled on and he seems to panic at first. And then that seems to kind of like move into a point of aggression. And then that seems to escalate into recklessness. So I wondered, did you see all of that? And what did you think was going on if you did see that? How did you perceive?
I was just like, why is this guy freaking out all of a sudden?
Okay.
I was not reading it as deeply as you did. I was more so annoyed because I just felt like, he was the character who was more like in control of his faculties. Yeah. And then all of a sudden he is like, you know, he almost got killed like several times at that point. And then he's just like, woo, like I'm invincible, you know, like he's the Alan Cumming of, just all these references, GoldenEye. he's like, I am invincible. Oh. And because he literally runs into a zombie and then he stands there for a second and he's just like, and then like, I think like smacks them in the head and then just continues on. So yeah, I didn't know what was going on with him. I was kind of annoyed by it to be honest. Like I liked that character up until that point. And then I was just kind of like, eh.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cause what I perceived was he got the blood on him and he knows that like if they bite you, you know, you're definitely going to turn like in so-and-so days or whatever. They said, you know, typically it took about 2 to 3 days for people to turn.
Yeah.
So I saw panic immediately thinking like, oh my God, there's blood in my mouth. There's blood in my eyes. There's blood up my nose. Like, you know, like, is this another way that I can get it or whatever? And that's what I kind of attributed his panic to. And then as he started to get really aggressive, I thought at first that he was just kind of unleashing all of that anxiety on the killing of the zombies. Like, okay, now you're going to die, motherfuckers, kind of way. Mm. And then when it went to full-blown recklessness, where he was just kind of like, ah, 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 to the point where Peter's in the other, you know, truck, like, sitting there going like, what are you doing, you know? And he's just losing his mind, but shooting it. And he's still killing them and everything. But at that point, I started to wonder, and I feel like it's deliberately ambiguous. I started to wonder if the blood intermingling with his own kind of like organic matter was like, this is like the first tipping point. Like you start
chemical
to lose
reaction.
Yourself. Yeah. To also make you start to lose yourself, to lose your identity. Like you may still have memories, which clearly he did, or no, he didn't. Steven did when he came back as a zombie because he remembered that fake wall and shit.
Yeah.
But I thought this must be the first shred of kind of losing whatever semblance of yourself has free will, maybe, to like not eat people or bite them or, you know, whatever.
Maybe it's just so like that seeing blood or just like having blood, like you bleeding or blood on you is like a trigger because like after when Steven gets shot later on, like, because these are like, he was acting very erratic in that scenario too later with Steven.
Sure.
So maybe it's just a thing that was just like blood triggers people and then they start acting recklessly and do stupid shit and it gets them
almost
killed.
Like a Pavlovian response, like the mindlessness.
Yeah, because those two characters, like the Rogers and the Stevens, are like they're the ones that are more capricious, we'll say, or just, you know, like they'll just whatever on a whim and then just act out. Whereas I feel like, because we talked about Peter being the more grounded and pragmatic type, and I feel that Fran is also, you know, like she's more logical as well. So just, it's interesting to see like who the people are that survive and how, you know, it comes to it that they survive. Because even, you know, at the scene at the end there when Steven is, you know, clearly we know that he's getting eaten in the elevator. But Peter hears the gunshots and he's kind of grappling, like, do I go back or do I just keep going upstairs? Yeah. And he ultimately decides, like, fuck it, I'm going upstairs. Which was smart because it was too late for him anyway. But it was just like, maybe that's the statement here. Just like, you have to make these difficult and logical decisions, because when you start to act impulsively and emotionally like the other two did, then that's when you die or, you know, get hurt or infected or, you know, whatever it is that's going to happen to you. So yeah, as far as the blood and all that, I just saw it as like an emotional response that, you know, then triggered him.
But then again, like, Peter has an emotional response. He thought he wanted to stay behind. He thought he wanted to either have them bite him and destroy him, or to undo himself so they can't turn him, or whatever he wanted to do. We knew he didn't want to go. And then all of a sudden, he makes a very emotional decision to go out shooting and go up the ladder. And you hated that?
I didn't hate that he changed his mind. I hated the fact that it was even there. Because I don't think that there was anything in his characterization throughout the entire movie that would suggest that he would be the kind of person that would just kind of give up like that, even for a second. That, I don't know, it bugged me. It felt unnatural with the character.
Okay, well, since we're on character now, like, let's go down that path because there's so much to cover. But I wanted to ask you. Did you have the scene, the exchange, when they're on the, I guess it's the helicopter. I forgot whether they were in a helicopter or a plane from time to time.
It was a helicopter.
But, because it feels like it was a helicopter the whole time. Yeah. Okay, cool. I'm like, they're airborne. That's all that I need to know. But while they were up there, after once the four, our core four, kind of like, you know, convened in the helicopter, and there's a scene that I got to see where Peter asked everyone in the cabin, like, did anyone leave anyone behind? And Fran says, kind of like flippantly, like, ex-husband. And Roger says, ex-wife. You know, again, emotionless. And then I think Steven is the one who has the presence of mind, because he doesn't have an answer or doesn't want to share his answer. He asks, how about you, to Peter?
Yeah.
And Peter says, some brothers. And that's when Fran, I think in the next take, like, asks him, like, so were these real brothers or were these like street brothers? Which I'm like, oh dear God. And he says, both. And she's like, oh, how many real brothers? Like, they're the only ones who matter. And then he says, two. And he starts telling her about them, like how one's like a pro athlete and another one is like, you know, just always kind of like, it just always seems to be at need. Like, there's a fraught relationship there.
Right.
And, Then later, I noticed when he was interacting with Roger, who's the first person he really seemed to bond with in the group when they're in the mall. I think it was in the mall. Maybe it was even earlier. Mm-hmm. But he called him brother. And I was just like, oh my gosh, like you're developing new attachments. You need to care about the people that you are interacting with. And it doesn't happen like that. You're not like, you know, developing a single white female kind of attachment. you're nice reference. But you feel a bond with this person. Yeah, but you feel a bond with this person and you're going to acknowledge it.
Yeah.
And then I started to notice when Peter, Roger, and Steven were all, they all seemed to be hitting it off when they were first gathering resources and getting the lay of the land in the mall. And I think that's when he first started calling Steven Flyboy. And Fran was just waiting and struggling, and we didn't know. I forgot that she was pregnant, so I didn't know. She was sitting there probably thinking, what the fuck am I going to do, you know, with this child that I'm going to have? Am I going to have it? Like all that. Mm-hmm. And then she has to start fighting the Hare Krishna zombie. But I felt like through that kind of establishment that, like, and a lot of warm scenes, warm interactions that happened throughout the rest of the movie, you know, like on a almost microscopic level, but they were there. That Peter was developing an affinity for these people. And when he had to lose more brothers, I wonder if something in him just felt unwilling to go on, felt like, you know what, I'd rather just stay behind. I'm tired of losing people I care about. That's what I thought. So.
Well, yeah, I don't think that scene or that exchange between Peter and Fran was in the cut that I have. I mean, it might have been. I don't remember it. I just literally watched it a few hours ago.
Yeah, me too.
That seems like something I would probably remember. But the thing is, the beginning of that movie, like the first 20, 25 minutes, is pandemonium. Like the movie literally starts off in chaos. I have no idea what anyone is saying, what is happening. Like the movie literally opens, it's, I feel like Fran's got this very Adrian King Friday the 13th, part two haircut, and she's,
you know, she's going to be, yeah,
she's sleeping. Yeah. She's resting against, it's like one of those like carpeted,
walls,
like a sound booth. It's all red. Everything's red. I'm just like, and she's kind of like, she's stirring a little, like she's having a nightmare. And all I could think about is just like, Friday the 13th part two. It's just like she's reliving the nightmare of the last movie.
No,
she wasn't in the last
movie. Yeah.
thankfully, someone wakes her up immediately and we're spared that.
We don't have any Night of the Living Dead flashbacks.
Yeah. That she wasn't even in.
Right, exactly.
But and then it's just like, everyone is just like running back and forth, and like the station manager, I don't know what, I had to look this up because I guess that like every other station was their broadcast had shut off, so they had the monopoly on everything, and he was just being like, well, we have to like keep running those, was it ads or something? And they're like, well, we don't have it, like we can't, like people are need just keep up to date with everything for their own survival.
Right.
And it was just like,
and then they were arguing about like keeping like the talk show going, like while these two are like playing politics and arguing over whether they need to stay on the air, literally can't even discuss that situation without about, like, cause they're talking about like emotion, about how we have to be clear headed and not emotional. Meanwhile, the pandemonium that you're speaking of is surrounding them in the soundstage, and they can barely hear each other talk because there's so many people shouting.
Interesting that is the debate of these commentators, because that's exactly what I think, like thematically, just in terms of the characters, where everyone lands. Because obviously the emotional two of that group didn't survive. And then the ones who were more logical and pragmatic did. So I didn't even think about that. Very nice. Very nice touch. And George Romero has he has two cameos in the movie, apparently. There might have been a third one that was the cut. I was looking through the trivia, but he was one of the camera operators or directors in that scene. And then I think he was later on a zombie in a Santa costume. I don't remember seeing him.
No, I don't remember seeing that either.
But some director cameos. And it's funny that because you're talking about all these scenes of the characters, and I feel that really, would have been helpful, because, you know, I'm sure that would have contextualized who they were a lot better. And it makes me think of Scream 4 and how, you know, like the theatrical cut of that movie is, I mean, like, you know, we love all the Scream movies, but I, when I watched the theatrical version compared to, even though there's not an official full cut, but just like the movie with all the deleted scenes inserted, and there's like more stuff with Jill and Trevor and all of them, it gives the characters so much more depth, and it just, it just makes the full story flow so much better. Just in terms of like where everything lands by the end, that I feel more wholly satisfied by it. So maybe that's, you know, what I have to do is I have to track down the full extended cut. From what I understand, there is no complete version of this movie. There's, you know,
there's no definitive.
There's 10 different cuts. Some have more than others. The, the Italian one, which I think we kind of alluded to earlier, is the Dario Argento cut, which is called Zombie in Italy, is, I think it's shorter. I'm not sure. It's just like, I know that they cut out a lot of the humor in the movie, because that was sort of Argento like financed Romero, or like his people financed Dawn of the Dead, and with the agreement that Argento could cut a version of the film for Italian audiences however he saw fit. And with that, he also got to put his own music into it. So we had Goblin, who, you know, did the score for Suspiria and Tenebrae and Deep Red. So they're, you know, the Italian version, which I've never seen. I would be interested in watching that just for the Goblin score, because apparently some of their music is still in the regular version here, but just a little bit that Romero kept in.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. So there's,
The score, the notable moments with the score that I can think of is just like kind of the wonky, you know, music that they use in the mall, like when they first arrive there and they actually seem to be playing it in the mall, and then the non-diegetic kind of bop, 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 bop. You know, like at the end.
Like circus.
Yeah. But also like weird, like circus meets advertising land. Like, I mean, it seemed like, you know, kind of like eat your pops and eat your cereal and pour your whole milk in the, you know, it just seemed like, I don't know, like something for like some kind of healthy food that isn't healthy that they would have advertised in the 70s, you know, like some sugary cereal that's going to like, got vitamins, but it'll give you diabetes, that kind of thing. but that also, okay, that brings up like, The symbolism thing for me, because it starts like to kind of rear its head here for me. This film, when being discussed, and whenever I've discussed it with people, even just after my single viewing, like I have only seen it once before today. Now I've seen it twice. But whenever we would discuss it, consumerism and capitalism would always come up. Like and even if whatever documentary you watch where it gets mentioned, they discuss consumerism and capitalism, you know, like the materialism within America and everything like that. Which I'm not here to argue against. I feel like that's very front and center, particularly in the shopping sequences with the living, and then with just like the dead people kind of like pervading like the boundaries that had been set, and like exploring the new territory and the speculation about them and why they're attracted to it and everything like that. But for me, the stronger theme that I was getting that seemed to be planted in small ways all over the movie was racism, in a way that I, knowing that this was supposed to be, you know, a kind of, I mean, I don't know how official it was. I don't know if it was promoted as the sequel to Night of the Living Dead, but I've, you know, I know that's kind of like in everybody's brain now that it is the next movie. There's
it's
the
his
night
series.
And then there's the Dawn.
You know, he has his Dead series.
Right. Because then we got Day, and then we got, you know, etc. But Land and whatnot.
Land, but Diary, and Survival.
Yes. There you go. Yeah. But with this one in particular, because I remember a lot of people bringing up race when discussing Night of the Living Dead. I remember it certainly occurred to me even when I was a young child. Like the movie was saying something that George Romero has gone on record to say that wasn't his original intention. He just hired the best actor for the job. And lo and behold, it ended up meaning something else.
In terms of Night of the Living Dead.
In terms of Night of the Living Dead.
Yeah.
With this movie, because it's built into the script and because there are characters who are full on spouting this, and even because there's like, okay, we'll go over like it kind of like point by point, but like this, the first example for me really is when they're waiting for Martinez at this bust that seems to have like the armed forces like called in, and you know, even if they're just police, like police officers with military type gear and everything like that. Yeah. And all of their, this racist rhetoric that's being spouted by, I don't even know this character's name, but the guy with the beard who won't shut the fuck up. I don't know if you have him in your cut. You probably do.
Yeah.
But he's going on about Puerto Ricans and black people, only he's using the N-word, and he can't wait to like give them what they deserve. He's commenting about how this shitty place, this building that they live in, is even nicer than the place he lives in. What did they do to deserve it? And then when they finally make the bust and they're shooting people, he's full on going into their homes as all the police are making their way down the staircase. He is full on kicking doors and shooting innocent families who live in the building of black and brown people, and he's just shooting them like he, like full, like, I am, you know, like going crazy the way, or not exactly the way, because he doesn't really have an excuse, but he's going manic in a similar way to the way that Roger is toward his end, or not to his end, but toward his biting and everything like that, which is the indicator of, it's the beginning of his end.
Yeah.
But this guy, I was just kind of like, wow, okay, don't remember this at all.
No, I forgot about that.
And then, yeah. And then later, there's a lot of like, again, like even just that exchange between Fran and Peter when she's asking about like, you know, well, what about your real brothers and everything like that? There seemed to be a kind of like racial dissonance there. Like, yeah. I'm only going to ask about the family that I understand because I don't understand what it is to make my own family, because here I am literally making my own family with this man who, as over the course of the movie, we're going to find we get farther and farther apart. There is a harsher divide between that couple as the movie progresses rather than kind of like bringing them together, which I find actually really kind of inspiring storytelling, because the natural inclination would be, and this, you know, and the good thing was it brought them all together. No, it didn't bring them all together. But yeah, so I mean, those are for a few examples. Like, did you observe anything like that, like while you were watching the movie?
Well, it's interesting that, you know, because when you even look at like the dead pandemic, and you know, if you compare that to COVID and all that, and just like everything that was going on politically in the world at the time, like George Floyd and that, of just like of just police who were almost like abusing their power in almost like an emergency state, where you know there's so much discord in the world, where it's almost like we're in control here, like we're at the top of the food chain, so we can do whatever we want. But it's almost like if I have a reason or a vendetta against a certain person or group or whatever, I'm going to take advantage of that because there's nobody here policing me. Like, I am the police. And that's kind of the sense that I got from that character, is that it was like a free for all. It's just like nobody, like it's like, it's almost like the purge. Like, you know, everyone is allowed to just like do everything, 'cause like the world is falling apart. And then,
of course,
you know, things will probably be fine. Like, just the typical pandemic mindset of just like, everything's going to be fine in like a few weeks or months or whatever, that nobody will, everything that happens, like it's like what happens in the pandemic stays in the pandemic. I think that's kind of like the mindset. So that's, yeah,
there's no such thing as consequence anymore.
Yeah, like that's what I got from that character. I also found it funny, not so much funny, but this is part of like maybe the film's like artistic charm or just visual charm of just, because it was every character, everyone who was a zombie had like the gray face. So you have these African Americans and they're like painted gray, like they're like whiter than the white people. So, you know, it's interesting to see like how like a dead zombified black person is portrayed in these movies as well. So there's definitely, if there was no intention behind Night of the Living Dead, if like, it was just, you know, what's his name? Dwayne, the actor from the Night of the Living Dead.
I don't remember his name.
I'll look it up. But yeah, that was just kind of like, he was the best man for the job. And,
of course.
And it wasn't so much of like a political statement. I feel that there is more purpose behind what Romero was doing here, telling this
story. I do too. Literally, when they were busting Martinez, I wrote this question. Is zombiness the great equalizer, where race is no longer a factor because we're all just blue and gray? Like, and there's no more like civilian versus police so much as like just living versus living dead, you know? And those are the only parameters we understand for a while, until I think the motorcycle gang comes in and just doesn't care who they make enemies of, and is, you know, reckless in that sense with indiscriminate killing. And we can get on that later. That was one thing that occurred to me.
Right. Dwayne Jones, by the way,
Dwayne Jones, okay,
is the actor there. Also, I don't know if you're aware of this, but so the original ending or an alternate ending for the film would have seen Peter shoot himself. And then in response to that, I guess Fran decided that, she didn't want to go on either. So she was like, got out of the helicopter and stood up and got decapitated by the helicopter blade.
And, like earlier.
Yeah. And Tom Savini had made the effect for, like, she had made the head of like the mold of Galen Ross. And just because they didn't end up using that ending, they didn't even film it. Or if they did film it, they didn't film any of the effects stuff of like the head, getting sliced off. So they saved the head because Tom Savini is like, well, I want to use the head. So the scene at the beginning when the racist SWAT guy kicks open the door and immediately shoots the guy in the head and it explodes, that is actually that head, like the Fran head. They painted it and put like a beard on it so it appeared as though it was a black man.
Oh, I see.
So it was the mold of a white woman. They then
reformed
to be African American and get their head blown off.
Right. Did your cut also have that one zombie who was chasing after Roger, I believe, and Roger was getting ready to shoot him, and then all of a sudden he just kind of, he was standing on a pile of boxes and he just stood up to his full height and the helicopter blade did.
Yes, I saw that. I was wondering about that too, because it was like, he was not A, tall enough, or B, standing on anything that even like would have a connection of like where the blade was and the top of his head.
Movie magic.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of like, I had to be like, is that what happened? I had to think about it. Also, I just like, it's just occurred to me, because I'm a huge fan of American Dad, and three out of the four characters are like characters' names from American Dad. You have Roger, Steve, and Fran. The mom, the alien, and
That's funny. Yeah. I wonder if that was intentional, because all I noticed was
like it was intentional for American Dad.
Yeah, I wonder, because I have never seen it, but I gotta watch that show. Yeah. But I did wonder, just because the two cis hetero white dudes who are in the foursome that were kind of like following through the movie were named Steve and Roger, and I thought together that's Captain America's alias, Steve Rogers. So I just thought, okay, Joe America. And the two of them are kind of the ones who I think the most worried about while we're going through the mall experience. I mean, in different ways, like because I don't know, there was something about Roger's kind of chipper quality. He could handle himself, but he was so kind of woo that I'd worry about that, like getting the better of him. And then with Steven, just everything about him worried me about him. Like once he started actually connecting with the two other guys, I started thinking, oh, good, you can play with the other children. Like you worry that is he going to be the bookish quiet one who's like in the corner by himself? And then Fran, thank God, like, you know, kind of like made herself part of the group also. But I did also notice, because it's like there's this strange regard between Roger and Peter in, I think it's the basement of the building where they meet each other, where everything's going down. And they, you know, we first see like all of these homes and we first discover the zombies, like visually, like kind of like already existing in some of these apartments and everything. And I didn't know if you had the scene with the priest, I'm guessing, who I called him Father Crutchy. I don't know what his name is supposed to be, but there's a man who has one leg and it looks like he's got a crutch attached to his other leg that he's using to walk on as his.
And he's the one, like he's trying to get by and he's like, can you just let me get by? Yeah, that was in there.
Okay, and he talks to them about like running versus staying, which I thought was really cool. And I felt like he was kind of like the Crazy Ralph of the movie, basically there to just let them know, just so you know, you're all doomed. Only I wouldn't ever call him Crazy Ralph. He's like a Lucid Ralph. That's what Father Lucid Ralph. That's what I should call him. But I also felt like there was a point where they look in the basement and they see kind of like where they've been keeping all these bodies, because the priest seems to know about that too. And he said the Lord's Prayer over them or whatever, gave them their last rites. And Roger asks, why do these people keep them here? And Peter said something that seemed significant to me. He said, because they still believe there's respect in dying. And it almost, the record skipped almost with me. I had to run it back and go, did I hear that right? Like, what does that mean? That there's respect in dying? Just because on one hand, I was looking at it as just kind of like take your problems and just kind of shut them away and just keep them away from you. You know, like survival mode and all that. Like now we're the living and we're safe in our space. But those who we don't know what to do with them. We haven't discovered really how to kill them yet. And maybe we don't have the resources. So we're just going to put them down here. Just keep them there until somebody can handle them, which seemed to have a more negative connotation. But when Peter said, because they still believe there's respect in dying, it's like, no, we have to put them aside so a priest can give them their last rites. So in case there is a soul in there, it can go wherever it needs to go instead of like being damned forever. Yeah. And also an odd humanity, like we don't want to kill indiscriminately. We just want to gather them somewhere so the people who do this, whose job it is to do this, can do it, because that's almost too trying on us. That's too, like, killing people is hard and we don't want to live haunted the rest of our lives, kind of thing. We seem very human.
There's definitely, there's definitely a juxtaposition between, we'll say, like, the main core characters and the biker gang, who do seem to just be doing it for sport almost. Like, not even, like, they're just in there, like, finding, like, creative ways of, like, how to kill these former people. And, you know, I think in terms of, like, our main characters, they're doing it more so practically. It's just, like, what makes sense for their survival. In fact, they're almost being like conservative to a point of just like, you know, we have ammunition. We only have like a finite amount of ammunition. I don't know if this ever came up, but it just seemed like that might've been in like more of like the, like putting up the barrier at the front. Cause it was just easier to like keep them out than, you know, go ahead and kill them. And there is a scene where they're like carrying bodies and storing them in some room. I wasn't too sure.
Because they're going to start smelling.
Yeah.
Cause they were going to start smelling. So they need to get rid of
them. Yeah. And then, of course, you know, we see that as well, where Peter has to put down Roger when he's reanimated. So it's, you know, there's definitely that does come up. It's not, you know, completely lost in the narrative of everything, but more so ever in the juxtaposition of the biker gang, I found.
Yeah, and there was also this weird Slight, but I feel like it's there, and I wonder if I watch it more often, if I'm going to catch more things. But I felt like there were a couple allusions, like a handful of allusions to World War II, just because the car, when everybody, when the four, our core four, team up together and decide to, like, you know, go for it, and, you know, like, and they're coordinated, and they've got everything, like, worked out. That was my favorite part of the movie, I think, actually, when they were just succeeding, and they were trying to get to the car, to the Volkswagen. Mm. That was the thing. It was a Volkswagen. And I remembered, I looked it up on BBC just so I could get, like, an accurate history of the Volkswagen, but I have Volkswagen was founded in 1937 as part of Nazi leader Adolf Hitler's vision to enable German families to own their first car. During World War II, the Wolfsburg-based firm manufactured vehicles for the German army, using more than 15,000 slave laborers from nearby concentration camps. And the only reason it occurred to me was I was like, that's a very odd choice in a movie that seems to be so kind of like United States of America laden, you know, like as far as just the familiarity of the mall and everything like that. Here we have this German car with at least problematic history and origin. And the only reason I bring it up is because it came out later when the motorcycle gang first kind of like introduced themselves. And there's like two major ones. There's like the Tom Savini one. And then there's the other guy who seems to be wearing, at first sight, it looked to me like a German helmet.
Yeah.
And I even like Googled or Ecosia'd because they plant trees. It's a search engine. When you search, they plant trees. So go on Ecosia, guys. Don't Google. But anyway, so I Ecosia'd German helmet, World War II, and I got two that looked like the one that that character was wearing. It was either an M35 or an M40. And I even looked, I was like, well, did they all look the same? I looked at American helmets, and no, American helmets had like a strap here and a strap under here, whereas Germans, it was a whole different deal. So I'm like, that it's like short here and then longer here for the German helmet. So I thought, okay, there's got to be some intention. I haven't even figured it out yet, but I'm just bringing it up because it struck me there were two World War II design, like production design allusions here. And I just wonder what that might have to say, maybe in terms of like an absolute inhumane violation of a world that would otherwise be harmonious, you know, that might be even utopian, where we can just kind of like have each other's backs. And even if we're not having the best time, we're surviving. We're well fed. We got clothes on our back. Like, we got what we need to survive.
Yeah.
And we can ask the questions. Our worst problem is this living, until fuckers show up and wreck it for everybody, you know?
And here, so I'm just looking at this motley crew and thinking that would be part of their fashion.
Totally.
That's all I thought of it. I just imagine they probably, because they've been looting all across the country, that they, you know, went into some pawn shops or whatever that maybe had Nazi memorabilia, because we don't see any swastikas or anything, but just like old war memorabilia, and just looted that. And that's kind of like what they've been driving around with because it looks cool.
It could also warrant a response, like without the audience even knowing, like it could warrant a response seeing that hang on a villainous character.
Given how visual this movie is, it's very comic book style, that's you're probably right in that regard of Romero just being like, we need to make this as like play, because there is like a quality to this, like, dare I use the word toyetic, just especially in terms of like the color palette and stuff. So I could see like, oh, here we have like little soldiers and you know, now we're playing with them. They're gonna come and invade the mall. The mall's like the Barbie dream house. And also, I wanted to ask you, how long do you think that they were holed up there? Because when Peter shoots Roger, like their apartment or like the storage room that they're living in is still like as they found it. But then in the next scene, it's like there's nice carpets and mood lighting and a sofa and plants and stuff. Like, they full on had furnished it. So I was wondering if you had a theory on how long they had actually been living there at that point.
Well, we know it's less than 9 months because she started to show, but she hasn't given birth to the baby yet. Yeah. So I always figured somewhere in the network of like half a year.
Because they already said she was 4 or 5 months pregnant when.
Oh, did they? Oh, shit. Yeah. Okay, then maybe then 3 or 4. I don't know.
Yeah. Because it seemed like a very long time, but at the same time, it's just like the timeline. It was just like it was all in like 3 days.
And when you have nothing else to do, like that was another thing. I love that time like became this kind of like irrelevant thing, because that's another thing we certainly experienced with the lockdown, with the initial onset in 2020 of and I don't want to make this all about, you know, COVID or anything like that, because that's just depressing. But it is there. But another thing that occurred to me, even when with the arrival of the motorcycle gang, I just wrote, the fucking human race can't have nice things without fucking it up. So immediately, senseless acts of aggression tear down necessary boundaries and the aforementioned respect in dying that, you know, Roger and Peter alluded to. Or Peter alluded to Roger. Like, that's done away with. And all of a sudden, like you said, like, this isn't survival anymore. This is blood sport. That was just something really, really kind of ugly to behold. And another thing that got me caught up in the movie, I didn't like what I was seeing, but I was definitely, I had a side. I was rooting for my side. When Peter was there shooting those fuckers in the head, I was like, yes, I was ready. I was in, again, Old Testament mode. Like, yes, fire, brimstone, sin upon your head, fucker. Yeah. Like, whatever.
And just speaking of like that scene, because, Tom Savini did most of the stunts throughout the entire movie. So he did that when, like, we can tell because when he's falling off of the upper mezzanine or whatever. And I guess shot, he missed the landing where they were, so he injured himself in that instance. Oh. It was just like all over the IMDb trivia because I had to look it up. But I mean, what a good sport.
Of course.
Going in there and
also. Someone else, Tasso Stavrakis, was in this movie. He was Tom Savini's assistant when they were doing the first Friday the 13th movie. He is the Harry Knuckles on...
For anyone listening, we both Pamela just Voorhees. Put our hands up and clenched our fists at the same time. What a world!
That's Tasso! What a world. I kept looking for him, but he's so hard to find because his photo... around that time, he has a few photos. Yeah, exactly. But you know, we're not getting anybody. Nobody's doing this in the shot. Somebody should have, but he didn't. Friday the 13th wasn't a thing yet, so George Romero wouldn't have known. But anyway, but I kept looking for him because around that time, it looked like he had a mustache and like long, you know, like ratted, like kind of like, you know, mussed up hair. Like, and
was he the one getting the blood thing? You know, where they the blood pressure test.
I don't know. Because that's a problem.
He must have been the one that was like, the guts were coming out. And apparently those were real cow intestines.
Maybe. I don't know. Okay. No, the intestines and all of that, like, I enjoyed that. Because that's the thing. I didn't have any kind of, like, bad moments reacting to, like, the practical effects in this movie. Once, again, like... I'm already involved on an emotional level, so there's, you know, suspension of disbelief. I'm just kind of like, oh, I know what they're supposed to be doing. So it didn't really take me out of it once. Yeah. I was just kind of sitting there going like, ew, you know, and wincing. Because somebody that I care about or somebody who I want to see, because that's another – I was cheering on the zombies when they were taking out the Sombrero dude and the little shit who kept firing that machine gun upward, like, indiscriminately. And then as they were driving out, he was on the back of a motorcycle, and then finally – Peter got him. He shot him, but he just
that might have been him. That might have been Tasso.
Maybe, but he didn't have a beard. But maybe Tasso didn't have a beard.
I'm just thinking because there's just like a lot of them had long hair, so I'm just
a lot with long dark hair.
Yeah,
but but then just to watch the zombies go to town on him, I was ready. I was like, yes, devour him. And I was not rooting for the zombies any other time in this movie, except for maybe against the racist guy in the beginning. But
and they didn't even get him.
But I really, they didn't even get him.
Peter shot him.
Yeah, he was gotten. Yeah. But and that was another thing. Like all of a sudden, we went from consumerism, you know, as this film is starting to wrap up a bit, to consumption. You know, like we went from like them kind of like, you know, this mall motif to now doesn't matter where you are, eating, food is food, and these things are looking for food. And it's just like, you know, that became the major showcase was, I guess, well, man devouring
consumption,
man,
or living is dead. Consumerism. You can't spell consumption
without the consume. Yeah.
Well, because you mentioned already that this movie, I mean, I don't know. I know there's a lot of like Hammer horror zombie films as well that would have been much earlier than this, and probably earlier than Night of the Living Dead even. I don't know if Night of the Living Dead was like the first zombie picture. And that's how little I know about the zombie subgenre. But was this maybe the first one that introduced the idea of the dead retaining their human memories? Because you already mentioned how Steven had the wherewithal to navigate back to their apartment
to the fake wall that they constructed.
But because when they get there, they're just talking. They're like looking at everyone walking around. They're like, why are they all here? Yeah. And just like, it's just kind of their memories. This is something that where when they were alive that they spent a lot of time here, so they came back and they just wander around.
Yeah, I don't know if it was the first. I definitely believe that George Romero himself is fascinated by zombies. Otherwise, he wouldn't have kept making movies about them. But I think he was fascinated by, like, well, what if something is left? And what? And playing with kind of the ratio of dead to living dead brain, you know? Because I know in Land of the Dead, I always remember that one black zombie who leads the rest of them, because he seems to have a little bit more cognizance, not just even about memories, but of his situation. He seems to be working things out. He seems to know if he leads them all to like this point, something good for them is going to happen. Like there's something that's going to benefit his community, as it were, his undead community. Yeah. But I wanted to ask you, because it's never really nailed down. There's speculation around it among the characters. What do you believe is attracting the zombies? Do you believe it's that just the behavioral pattern as they were living, that it's drawing them back to the mall? Or what do you think it could be? Do you have an idea?
I like to think that's what it is.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, what is it? It's just like the blood that's, you know, like they smell the fresh meat and they're just kind of slowly making their way towards it.
I mean, and it does add like, again, like an air of tragedy that I usually, you know, don't, it's the reason I don't see a lot of this kind of material that's zombie based, because it always seems to be laden with tragedy and loss and all of that. But it's like a velvet tragedy, like almost kind of like watching someone on the news and going, oh, that's terrible. Yeah. Like I'm watching these people kind of like just go through the motions because they don't quite know who they are anymore. But they kind of remember, oh, the hum of the fluorescent lights and the bland muzak that's playing, like, you know, this is comfortable for me, maybe.
Yeah, I think it's just maybe like a, you know, it's a thing of like, I see it, I want it, I take it. And, you know, just like if that's the memory of just going to the mall, because there's, you know, things to consume there. And then, you know, like, oh, I'm also a flesh-eating zombie. There's some flesh walking by. Like, I'll just help myself right there. You know, we're in the food court. So, that's what I imagine it would be. And just in terms of zombie movies as well, because I will say, like, other than the remake of this and whatever misgivings I might have inferred to at the beginning of this, I still think this is probably one of the best zombie movies there is. Like, it's a solid movie. Make no mistake about that. I just agree with your analysis of just like the bleakness and like almost a cynicism. Like, I feel that like this movie isn't entirely cynical, just, you know, based on the way it ends. What is the line that they just like, how much fuel is left? And they're like, not a lot. And
And it's just like, okay, there's a very, there's an essence of we'll deal, you know, kind of thing. and they just kind of fly off into the sky.
Yeah.
And just kind of like, we'll make the best of what we find when we find it, which I actually find, I don't know, really heartwarming. Because also it's preceded by, I did actually feel something when Flyboy Steven got taken down by Peter, because again, there had been this, I don't know how much of their exchange after Roger's death you got to see, or I don't even know if Roger was dead at this point, but at some point Roger was kind of out of commission at least, but I don't know if he was dead yet, but they had a scene where Fran and Steve are dressed up like they're going to have a fancy dinner.
That's there. Yeah.
And okay. And Peter comes in cause he made it, and they're like, well, aren't you going to sit down? And he's like, no, this is all for you. Kind of like, and I don't know if he had prior knowledge of like what Steve's plan was for the evening or anything like that, but he backs out and everything like that. And I'm just kind of like, oh, that's so sweet. Like it felt very familial, you know? And then something completely unforeseen from my eye happened when Steven proposes to Fran and she refuses. And I even wrote the line down. She says, we can't, Steven, not now. It wouldn't be real. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, okay, that's another line I had to like kind of like pause and just kind of go, it wouldn't be real. Like, what does that mean? Like, because there's no like justice of the peace and there's no like my mother and, you know, we can't invite her family. Like, what is it that like invalidates it? And I also wondered if that was a line, because I feel like it's open to interpretation. Is this kind of like the first way she's really spelling out for him, our relationship is going nowhere. It wouldn't be a real marriage.
This is going because nowhere.
Because
DJ Souls.
Like Linda in Halloween. But and then she just calls up someone else. Like, I prefer to like date
I'm Linda calling zombies. Jamie Lee Curtis. This is going nowhere.
Yeah, right. This is going nowhere. But no, I just felt like, is it her way of telling him like no, the relationship part, like we can play house and everything like that, but the real relationship is you and I both know it's over.
Okay.
And
then
Well,
do you want me to like, because there's a few things to address. Or did you have more to add to that?
I have more, but I always have more. So go ahead.
Go for it. Just in terms of, Roger was dead at that point. And, you know, I looked at that as more, because I don't think that like Peter would put himself into a situation like that where, you know, like Steven said to him, just like, hey, I need you to like make us a meal and serve us, you know, just like, just the optics of it are not like not great. Let's have the black man wait on us hand over foot.
Right.
I think that
maybe
he
just knew that Peter wanted to cook for them.
I think it was probably something that, you know, maybe a conversation that those two men had on the side, and he's just like, I want to propose to her. I just want to give her like a sense of normalcy for one night. And he was probably like, yeah, absolutely. Let's do that. You know, obviously they're all bonding. It's a very human thing. Cause I don't think that she was in on it. Cause that's when she was just kind of like,
no, of course.
Stay with us. I almost wish there was like a shot of just like him glancing over at Steven and Steven being like, you know, like
doing the net cut.
And in terms of her just saying like it's not real, I mean, I don't think that this is a thing, like as much as, you know, maybe in your cut there you've found more characterization, there's more development, because I still feel that these are largely very underdeveloped characters. So I didn't really get a sense of what their relationship was, or, you know, where it was heading, because it still seemed like she was dependent, or, you know, codependent on him up until the end, when she was just like calling out for him, and Steve or Peter's just like, I don't think he's coming, you know, like we got to get out of here. So I don't think that it was an issue of her just being like, yeah, if we were, like, the only reason that we're still together is because we're locked in here. I didn't see that. I just saw it more of just like, this is, the world's not the same. It wouldn't be real because, you know, our relationship is real to us, but just in terms of like how it relates to the outside world, like there is no, like the, the foundation of marriage and all that is, it doesn't mean anything at this point, because, you know, we're just locked up inside of a mall and it's just like us and this third guy here. So I think it's more so, if she meant that, it wouldn't be real, that this is something where it's just not a priority for her in her life. It's just like, let's actually find something, like find some purpose, or just go somewhere where we will have purpose, which I think it was always her intention. She always wanted to keep going, apparently, to Canada, and they wanted to Canada, stay in the mall. So I think that, you know, very well, like that's what she ultimately wanted, with was to have a life with him. So I did not see, I mean, I don't really see much of a relationship between them, but I also don't see the kind of like the end of a relationship either, if that makes sense.
Well, did you also have the moment where he takes a picture of her and he's got this smile, I think, on his face, and she's just kind of like, great. When you finish the roll, we'll drop it off at the drugstore. And then immediately his smile drops away, like, fuck. Like, I'm trying to have fun and, like, do something coupley, and you're not on board with me, right? Did you have that moment? Do you know?
I don't think so.
Do you remember it?
I don't think so.
Oh, okay, cool.
I did have the moment where she was where she was, like, putting on the makeup.
And, like Harley Quinn.
And she had the gun. She was being all like seductive.
Yeah. And that was another thing, like in that context with her, like not wanting a part of that photograph, that session he was trying to have with her. And then all of a sudden, like to go right into the makeup and the gun. And also for it to be so almost kind of like adjacent, like it's giving her almost like a dead look because she's very, very pale. Yeah. So it's the most zombie-like she looks in the entire movie. And yet at the same time, I feel like she's also playing with like identity. Like there's like, I could be anybody, you know, if I just could get away from this fucking guy who keeps trying to mom me, you know, to like marriage me. And if I could just, you know, I could just go off and I could be a gun-toting Harley Quinn if I wanted to.
See, maybe that's where the context is lost in the shorter cuts, where we don't really get to see all that.
Because also there's that moment where they're fighting over the TV. Did you have that too?
There was some like TV stuff. Yeah. I don't remember.
Okay, because the TV's on with like white noise and static and everything, and they're waiting. And
because it hasn't been a broadcast for 3 days or something like that.
For 3 days, she says, "Why don't you give up?" And then he goes and sits down, and then she goes over, turns it off, and sits down. Then he goes over and turns it on and sits down. And she says, "What have we done to ourselves?" And I'm like, "What the fuck is going on?" And like, it looks so awkward for, I feel so bad for Peter at that particular moment, because I've been around that couple. I've been in the middle of that fight, and you just want to keep things socially just kind of like, all right, I'm just going to focus on my food. Maybe it'll pass. Maybe they'll realize I'm here and they won't have to hash it all out right now. And if they do, I'm going to slowly gather my, I'm going to take my plate and my salt and my drink, and I'm going to go into the next room and hopefully they don't tell me to stay. But that was another thing that just kind of like kicked it off. Like, okay, these two, something's going on. There's something huge happening in this relationship. It feels like it's deteriorating before my eyes, and I only have a few clues, but
if we go back to the very beginning, because like the first time we see them together, like he's being very, like he's basically like, meet me on the roof, on the rooftop at, I don't know if he says rooftop, but she says, I know like later she very verbally says the roof. And me being Canadian, I always find that so funny. But it's just like meet me on the rooftop at 9. We're gonna, I guess they're stealing the helicopter. That was already like the thing. Yeah. Like these people are not the most scrupulous, like this whole group. Like they're just like, you know, fuck everyone else. Like there's the guy who's just like, do you have any cigarettes? Did he come back later? Was he the guy that was on the mall rooftop at the end? Because he had a very distinct look, like just his eyes were very close together, and I thought I saw him again.
The headset guy,
the one that was just
the one who was like over
the one that was like asking for cigarettes when they took off From
when they took up I don't remember.
But yeah, anyway, they're just kind of like, it was almost like, we can't take any more, or you know, something like that. But then they're like, no, we don't have any cigarettes. And then literally they take off. So they're stealing the helicopter, and then they all take out cigarettes and start smoking. And that's not to mention the fact that she's pregnant as well. She's just smoking.
Oh, God, she smokes like a chimney. Yeah. I'm so glad we didn't have to see what that did to the baby. Because that's another thing that happened. Like, I bring up, like, the guy who... in the beginning, like, who stood out to me also the most, like, there were a lot of lines that just kept jumping out at me, because she's talking to that guy and he's just kind of like, well, you know, like, you're going to be on here or whatever. I don't even know what he's saying, but he's telling her about, like, how the other stations are shut down and how pretty soon this one is going to be too or whatever.
By midnight,
and all I remember is the last line he says is, our responsibility is finished. And again, that just opens the door for what you were mentioning in terms of just like this post-apocalyptic, you know, like chaos that is being unleashed, and this recklessness that people feel, you know, that they're immune to consequence because as a people, our responsibility is finished, you know, like let's be as selfish as humanly possible.
Which like just begs the question too, like, how are they getting paid? Sort of thing. Like, were they being paid in advance? And it's just like, you know, we have you until this time, because if you're like getting paychecks that aren't coming in until like the next week, and it's just like the world is ending, but like your shift is over at midnight, but you have to stay for your whole shift. And then you're no longer contractually or, you know, obligated to the station or whatever. And you've been like, well, fuck that. I'm never going to see that money anyway. So I may as well just leave whenever the fuck I want. So I don't know. I found that kind of funny. But yeah, in that exchange, like, he was very much like, it was kind of ultimatum-y, if I remember, of how he got her to.
Yeah, it was pretty aggressive.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. It was almost like kind of like my way or the highway, baby. And he had that weird kind of bland, dopey leading man quality that I was like, please don't let him be the hero of the film. I don't remember him very vividly. So I hope I either like him eventually, which I did, or I cared for him. And then, or I hope that, like, you know, he just dies real soon.
I will say, of that actor, though, I don't know any of the actors.
Yeah.
Other than Galen Ross and Ken Foree. But he played zombie really well. Like, that was one thing I noticed. Like, when he came out of that elevator and just, like, I was just like, oh, my God, he's going to fall over. And then he did. He kind of did this, like, his foot was caught and he did this, like, spin around. I was just like, he's doing that really well. And then I was looking at the trivia, and I guess George Romero even, like, commented and just said that his zombie performance was his favorite of, like, any performance in his movies. And I guess that the actor had kind of modeled it off of what's the guy who plays the mummy?
Boris Karloff?
No.
The other mummy?
I guess so.
He was the original mummy. Karloff was.
Anyway.
All right.
There was a lot of trivia. I'd have to go through it. But they, you know, just in terms of everyone else, because there was like hundreds of extras here playing zombies, that Romero was asked, like, do you give specific directions to your extras of just like how to act as zombies? And he's like, absolutely not, because then there's a uniformity to what they're doing. And it's just like, it's almost like synchronized zombie walking. So he basically just gave the direction to every single person. Just act like you're dead. And then everyone did their own thing. And it worked.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
It works so much better that way too, because you're going to have your own individual means of getting around like you were when you were alive. This actor who played Steven is David, I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly, Emge? E-M-G-E. I don't know how else you would pronounce that. And just because I have it in front of me and we haven't mentioned his name, Emge.
Yeah.
And, and Roger was played by Scott H. Reiniger. Who I also thought did like a really, really good job. I didn't feel like there were any weak links in this movie. Like, everybody totally, like, I bought them as like the characters they were portraying and that they were in the situations that they were in. So bravo.
I agree. I just felt that there wasn't enough characterization
in the beginning, because I was over 35 minutes in before we reached the mall, which was kind of stunning to me. I don't know if you,
I think it was, I might've, I know I did put like the display up to see how much time had passed. And I think it was like 25 to 30 minutes.
Okay. Okay. Because there was also that, as they were flying, hovering over in the helicopter before they reached the mall, like just before, and before they gassed up at, I guess, what was that? Like a, I don't know, a gas station, radio station. Yeah. I don't know what the fuck it was.
Where the two children zombies,
yes,
ran out. Apparently that's yes. like the only time that like zombies have ever run in this.
Yeah.
And I guess they just didn't think about it. They just like, it's kids.
It worked for me.
Yeah.
I thought it was great.
That scene always, like, I watched that and it reminds me of like one of the Resident Evil movies. Cause there's always like some gas station or somewhere where they stop sure. off at early on and there's like a threat looming in a closet. I mean, I'm sure this was the only film to do that, but then, it might've been Resident Evil Extinction or something. I just seem to recall characters like going somewhere and then just like thinking everything is fine. And then shit jumps out. But there is a nice moment there. Well, not a nice moment, but like a character building moment, in which, Steven is like shooting at the zombie and Peter's like right behind the zombie. And it's just like, you almost shot me. And then he kind of chews him out after for being so irresponsible with a gun. That I liked. I feel like that.
Yeah.
We needed more of that, you know?
He holds a gun at him and he's just kind of like, doesn't feel good, does it? Or whatever the line is. And he's just kind of like,
that whole sequence like, kind of pissed me off. Great. And just like, especially more so with Steven and Fran, because what the fuck were they doing? Like I seem to recall like he was like tackled by a zombie or something. And then they're like struggling on the ground. He's like has a mallet or something that is out of arm's reach. And she's standing there.
Yes.
Just stare. And it's not like she's paralyzed by fear. She's just standing there.
No.
And she's confused. Meanwhile, there's another zombie walking.
She's watching it play out.
Yeah, there's another zombie walking up to her ever so slowly. Yeah. And I'm just thinking, like, are you going to do something? What are you going to do? And he grabs the mallet, whacks the thing in its head, gets up, and then immediately, like, stumbles into the next zombie. Like, there's no coordination. Yeah. And after everything is said and done, they're just like, bawling, you know, they're just like, oh my god, that we came so close to death. And just like, how that, like, you literally were so clumsy that you fell into not one but two zombies while your girlfriend just stood there. And it's just like, I don't, what do I do, you know?
But see, I liked that because it made me dislike them. It made me root for the cops over the civilians. And which I, you know, in this day and age, you couldn't tell me that I would be doing that. And then later to have them like in the mall to see Steven actually making a connection with them. I'm like, good, I want to see you do acting like that. Now, what's her problem? And then I find out she's pregnant and they're planning it. So she takes a stand. I'm like,
okay, she's pregnant. And maybe she didn't want to get involved for the sake of the child. I'll give her that.
But still, she could have done something. Like, I mean, I agree with you at that particular point. I didn't like them either, but I liked that I didn't, in retrospect, I like that I didn't like them because, again, it like we had this similar kind of conversation about Megan. When you're watching people who are kind of like dislike, unlikable.
Oh, or
yeah. but you're also kind of, you know, but they're not unpalatable. Like you can sit there and have an opinion about like what they're doing wrong and that keeps you engaged. I totally did that with the members of this crew who I didn't like on sight.
With Galen Ross, who plays Fran, played Fran, she, I guess, told Romero that she wasn't going to scream. Like there was like cues in the script where just like, you're going to scream here. And she's just like, no, because I feel that will make me like perceived as like a weaker female character. And I mean, that's it. This is an interesting gray area because, you know, if we look at like, you know, Scream, the franchise, because you have, I mean, more so I think like Courtney Cox, like she's in like, this is a, no. You know how I love bringing it back to Scream, but it's true because I don't think that like screaming, I don't think is a, like a masculine or a feminine attribute, because I think that like a character like Gale Weathers in Scream is obviously like a ball busting, like tough as nails, You know, she can get the job done on her own thing. And she's constantly like, you know, she's just like, van door opens, Randy's body, scream. I think, like probably in like every single movie, there's a moment, you know, the one with like, Parker Posey over the railing where they scream. And it's just like, she's already proven herself that she is not a, like a weak, like timid female character who needs to be rescued by a man. So I don't like, I don't necessarily agree with that logic of just like, don't let, I don't want to scream because it's going to make me appear to be weaker. I think that a character like Fran was already appearing weaker because of shit like, you know, not being very active in that moment that we just discussed where she was just standing there confused. I think that like her strengths definitely come in later. Like it's not until like maybe the second half of the movie that she really comes alive for me that I'm just like, oh, okay, actually, like here's a strong female character that, you know, I can glom onto. But up until that point, I just like, you may as well have made her scream. Like there's nothing about like, well, screaming that I think is like undermines a, right. like a female character.
Okay. Well, point one, I agree with you in terms of, I don't believe a scream should be engendered. And I don't believe it is because, I've been to plenty of Horror Nights mazes and everybody screams. So there's that. But I, as far as her point, I think I understand because it's not a big screaming movie. There's not a lot of screaming coming from the male characters. So comparatively, if she's the screamer and she's the only woman on screen who has a name and a backstory that we learn anything about, then I can understand why comparatively, because that's another thing, like with Courtney Cox or any of the women in the Scream movies, the women are not the only ones doing the screaming. There is just as many men who are screaming.
Oh, I think as a David Arquette of, like, you know, screams more than
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Like for comedic effect. So that's our doofy. But, but I think, like, again, like, I feel like that could conceivably also be laying the groundwork if she's kind of having a non-reaction to Steven being attacked by multiple zombies. Maybe they're not that in love. Maybe she's, you know, maybe it's not like, you know, a traditional relationship.
I also feel that zombie, like the zombie subgenre isn't, like screams aren't as conducive to the horror in them. Because I feel that like with every zombie movie, unless it's like the beginnings of the zombie pandemic where it's just like we've never seen a zombie before and it's the first time, like, you know, maybe I'm thinking more of like Barbara in Night of the Living Dead, then it's just like, okay, I can understand that because, like, you know, when you're in a slasher movie and there's just like surprise, there's a killer standing behind you, that's scream worthy but I feel like when you're in a scenario where it's just like, you know, that zombies are around and you already, you know you have to have your wits about you, that, you know, it's I can see if that was the reason it just like, I don't make me scream because this is a character who is logical and they wouldn't be like having an emotional reaction. I'm glad that she didn't, because I don't think, like, I agree with you, I don't think that there's room for screaming in this movie or really like any zombie movie for that matter. But I just thought it was an interesting trivia that, you know, I didn't expect for us to talk about so much, but
Totally. But another element at that particular moment also when they're at that particular stop is the out of order sign on the coffee machine and the fact that, like, we get to see Peter. I think he might press a button or two, but he just basically kind of bangs the machine like, fuck, damn it, I can't even just have a cup of coffee. And then the irony is that, like, this out-of-order coffee machine he's banged some life into, and now he's got coffee if he wants it. And I thought also what the movie was setting up with that moment is you have to try. You know, you can't just take things at face value. If you've got something that you want, you've got to – even if – because, I mean, that's a moment where he is actually kind of giving into his emotion, and he gets a reward as a result of it. And it's just kind of like, okay, I have to stop, you know, letting things get in my way and getting exasperated about them. Or if I get exasperated, use it to experiment and try to get the thing working. Like, I thought that was something about his character, again, that endeared him to me. And then later, the only reason it's kind of important to me is because when they unpack the food in the mall, and the first line that I said at the top of the podcast, when they unpack the spam, and what does Fran do? She just looks like a spam. And they're just like, well, you know what I mean? It's just like, amazing. Like, of course, like it's the end of the world. And the one inedible thing, the one thing that's going to stand the test of time and exist longer than any of us, aside from the roaches, is Spam.
Yeah, I don't remember Spam, but I remember something about there was a canned food. And there was a line about something that's just like, well, we don't have a can opener. So it's just like, there's a built-in can opener or something. So I don't know if that was the same. Right,
because it's a spam key. Yeah. Okay. But so it was like just kind of her disdain juxtaposed with Peter's willingness to try.
You know, I've never
I took as a sign.
I've never had Spam.
Yeah. I wouldn't recommend it. No, but, I mean, are you a big pork person? Like,
no. Well, I'm kosher. You know?
Yeah, you're kosher.
Not actually, but my family is Jewish, so we never really like had pork. But I mean, like we ate bacon a lot, so just by and convenience, not kosher bacon. I always just assumed it was like a reason to just like, oh, they invited us for like Christmas or something. It's just like, no, we can't. We're kosher. It's more by like for antisocial purposes, I would assume. We're just gonna stay home and cook some bacon.
Another thing that I liked that just kind of fed like the consumerism symbolism in it was just the first thing when they're going to grab stuff, Peter's like, let's get the stuff we need. I'll get a television and a radio. And I just thought, even though I know they're probably getting the television so they can keep abreast of like news and whatever, and the radio, same deal, to try and like connect with people. But just the fact that it was being exclaimed like in a mall, like it did feel like kind of consumerism.
Here's a question for you. If you're in their shoes and you're trapped in a mall and you have free reign of the entire facility and every store, what are you going to get? Like, don't even think like, I mean, sure. If your mind immediately goes to like practicality and, you know, more so tools for survival, but what are things that you might be like, and this is for me, you know, this is just, it's specifically just something for myself. What would you, what would you hoard?
It's really sad to admit it, because I don't think of myself as a big coffee drinker, but if there was a Starbucks or a Coffee Bean or a Pete's Coffee or any, or even just an independently owned like coffee house or bar, I'd probably want to get in there and get as many drinkable liquids as I could with as many powders and syrups and whatever, just so I could, and also just get like a bag of ice if I can. Like, I'd try to make maybe four, so I could put them all in like a little holder, four venti or large, you know, coffee drinks or tea drinks or something, you know, like whatever is at my disposal. So, cause that's comfort food to me. That would, I could see like in a crisis how sipping something like that, it's almost like Starbucks or any of those kinds of coffees, those, you know, those designer milkshake coffees have kind of like, eclipsed like Happy Meals from when I was a kid, because I loved Happy Meals and pizza, you know, fast food and everything like that. Now my kind of fast food Happy Meal equivalent is like, I want a frappuccino. You know, I don't say it like that, but my inner voice is very, you know, I want my sippy cup. So I'd probably do something like that. Okay. But if I had lost someone, I'd probably go look for some liquor too. Just to take the edge off, just so I don't completely lose it, because I'm a pretty happy drunk, or at least I'm not a big dramatic drunk. So what about you?
Okay. Well, I mean, that seems very conservative to me. I would go full out. I mean, like, first of all, I would probably be, you know, make like one entire run of just going around to like all the clothing stores and just like looking for what is the most expensive thing. Like, I wouldn't even like look for fashion. I'd just be like, whatever the most expensive thing, like it's like Cordelia, Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Like, I need to have it, not because it's expensive, because it costs more. And that would be my reasoning behind it. So I would probably like just hoard up on like a lot of clothes and just like have a different
designer.
Yeah, just have a different outfit for every day of my like pathetic pandemic quarantine existence inside this mall. And I would probably also, I mean, like, I really love Lego. So if there was like a Lego store or like some sort of store that had Lego sets in it, I would just like get all of it. And I would just like, that's would be my fun of just like building little plastic brick things with the instructions. And I would probably, if I had access to like a TV and Blu-ray or 4K player, I would go to like the movie music store and just like, I would literally go through the shelf and just like grab all my favorite movies, all my favorite horror movies, or just like stuff I haven't seen as well. And just, you know, build up my own little collection in the mall.
So, that's cool. Yeah. I honestly, I think my first, like my first impulse, I think was absolutely right about me, because I don't think I'd be thinking that long term right away. I think I'd be like instant gratification, immediate need, like what's going to calm me down so I can think more clearly. So then I can start thinking and like, maybe I can, and what can I drink? I'm going to get decaf so I can sleep. And then when I wake up in the morning, okay, shower. What are we going to do about that? Toiletry, you know, starting going down the survival list, but instantly it'd probably like, okay, I need a sugar fix and I need a drink probably, you know? And if there's a weed store, hey, why get some edibles, you know, why not? Just for my stash, I would need like a little stash first, and then I'd start thinking like in terms of, I'd probably take everything that you didn't take in the label, like that. But be like, oh good, there's double XL or X small, because Zach took
and then we and then I would run into you and just be like, oh, you're wearing the same thing, like, you know, like.
So we're not only two sizes thing. Too small. Thanks a lot, Zach. Thanks for hoarding. Right,
I don't think I have anything else I really wanted to go over. So before we get to the cherry picker, do you have any final thoughts?
I mentioned that my favorite sequence, I think, was them like cooperating and toting guns and wheeling Roger around like a baby. Because that was another thing I loved, just like kind of like. Even when they were when they were shopping, he was just kind of like grabbing stuff. And again, the consumerism came in, but also just like the weird, there was some part where Fran was pushing Roger and she just kind of left him by the fountain and then kind of wandered away to go get God knows what. Mm-hmm. And he was just sitting there, just kind of looking at the fountain, I guess. And it was just kind of like, oh my gosh, what that told me and what everything kind of like surrounding those events were telling me, that nothing ever really changes. You know, like you still find the people, whether they're children or people who, you know, have been bit or whatever. Find people who need you, who are going to depend on you, who, you know, you can boost. Yeah. But you also need to be able to kind of like leave them to look at the fountain or, you know, look at the television, go to the arcade so mommy can go get her hair did, you know, or whatever. Yeah. And, but I also, there was a moment, after that, there was one moment first where Fran was just kind of sitting there with her gun and a zombie came and just kind of knelt on the other side of the divider. And she just kind of looked at him, you know, and didn't have any response. Again, no response whatsoever. Not even fear, not even interest though. Just like a blank kind of, yep. Hi, you know, like, so I was like, oh, growth. She's she's not scared and she's not anything. But what I really appreciated after it, because they killed a bunch of zombies then, they had a moment in my cut where the four of them were all like at the highest landing or mezzanine or whatever, you know, at the railing, just looking down at the aftermath at all the dead bodies or the undead dead bodies strewn about. And there was no celebratory sense to like the group. They all just seemed tired and kind of over it. And the fact that
like, we got to clean this shit up now, you know,
right.
Think of the mess, you know, like that's,
well, and also that, yeah. Cause there's not much to celebrate. Like it's kind of like, good, we did it, but we still have to survive now. And also the fact that they had Roger being bit. I loved Fran had a line as she was coming away from him saying, he seems to be sleeping. And I was like, yeah, cause we don't know what the fuck is going to hit him and when. Well, you know he's going to turn into a zombie. Yeah. We don't know when. So he could be sleeping, but could also be laying in wait, you know? Yeah. So I think just the kind of like the accessibility. Oh, there was one thing I had a question about. Like there was the fucking ice skater at one point. Like there was a sequence where we were just kind of all over the mall and they were shopping. Then all of a sudden there was like a lone skater on the ice and I couldn't tell if it was one of them or if it was just like some zombie who was maybe skating when they got bit and got back up and then just started just skating in a loop for eternity. It was Fran? Okay. I couldn't tell. Because yeah, I thought, if that's a zombie, that's fucking hilarious.
Galen Ross had on her resume that she could ice skate. And she could, like, 20 years prior to that. But she hadn't in that much time, so she didn't know how. So when they got on the ice, like, it was almost like this thing is just like, shit, I'm going to lose my job because I lied on my resume. And then I guess, like, after, she was able to do, like, stay up enough to just, like, do the, like, a circle around and then... George Romero told her afterwards, he's just like, oh, you should have told me. I would have just like cut that out of the movie altogether if I had known.
Yeah. Probably, I guess the last thing that I can mention that I really appreciated is the when they have to take Roger out. And by they, I mean, you know, Peter. But I love that there's the, again, we're back to the talking head political discussion that's happening on the television set, the eternal argument that seems to be all led with the cerebral cortex, if you will. And that's again juxtaposed against the very personal sense of necessary execution in this world, and how it hits somebody who whose, you know, connection runs deep, like Peter does. That there was, I don't know, I just the more I watched the movie, the more I was like, I think this might be my favorite zombie film. I'm gonna have to revisit the entire subgenre now, just so I know, because I don't, like I said, I don't revisit these movies. I see them once and I tend to like them, and then I move on with my life. Even the really, really popular ones like Shaun of the Dead, or was it The Day, the Dead Don't Die, was that the Jim Jarmusch?
I will say that I definitely after having this conversation with you and just hearing you, just hearing your perspective and just the extra scenes that you were able to see and how you could contextualize that. I do feel like, okay, maybe I had a better experience, because, you know, I was on the fence when we started this podcast. So I do think that, you know, it's good. Like, I was, you know, I would have said like 4 stars out of 5. Like, I could go 4.5. Because obviously I try to, whenever I letterboxed something, I try to make it as like personal to me as possible. So we'll see. Absolutely. Like, it's, I think this is a great movie. I just, one that... like, I hadn't seen it in so long, and I don't think I'll watch it again for a very long time. But, you know, I'm glad that we chose this for this week's episode.
So, me too.
Without any further ado, let's get to the cherry picker.
It's not like they killed people. On purpose.
Okay, first order of business. We need to pick a cherry on top. What are your thoughts? Because I could do one or two and I don't really care.
I felt like it was undeniable while I was watching the movie that Peter is the cherry on top. I adore everything about the performance. I adore everything about the character. I have a crush on the man. So yeah, he's my cherry on top.
I mean, other than the whole abortion thing, I mean, like, I agree with you. I wish that wasn't there. It's just kind of like, what the fuck? Like, what was that?
He redeems himself. It made him
seem kind of sketchy. But okay,
well, nobody's perfect.
I am fine with that. So last week we asked you who deserves to die the most in Thrigen, aka Megan. I nominated the therapist. You nominated Brandon, the little shitty kid. And across Patreon, Instagram, and YouTube, the total was 167 for the therapist versus 633 for Brandon.
Thanks, guys.
I just want to point out that on Patreon, it was actually higher for the therapist. So thank you for that. Usually it's the other, like, the Patreon are always on your side. I feel so betrayed by
Or isn't Instagram usually on my side too?
Instagram and YouTube were both on your side for this one by a large margin. But let's hear the comments.
Yes.
So Anahi Vasquez says Brandon was giving aspiring serial killer vibes while the therapist was just doing her job.
Nice.
Not very well, may I add. Jeremy Huff.
Dying for. Go on.
Jeremy Huff, definitely Brandon. He was bad enough before, but the whole treatment with Mthrigan before she attacked gave off really sadistic vibes. The therapist would have been a nice additional kill to add to the body count, but Brandon's actions can't be ignored.
Nice.
Sucked. Says Brandon was a child that had a bad mother, but the therapist was way too judgmental to be a proper therapist. Mthrigan knew what was up with her.
Okay.
Thomas Baker, Zach, you and Eddie should talk about the faculty and sick on February.
All right.
Okay, yeah.
We'll see. I don't know.
We love getting suggestions. It doesn't mean that we will go for them, but, you know.
Feel but free don't, to don't make stop. Them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool Nerd the Third says, my jaw hit the floor when Brandon died. I did not expect that from a PG-13.
Oh, you know, okay.
It happens.
Thanks for sharing.
Yeah. Grant Dempsey. Oh, Brandon's your typical sociopathic horror movie bully kid. He exists just to die, but there's no fun in giving him to the cherry picker for that. I'd probably vote for Gemma if I could, but I'm almost as happy voting for the therapist anyway. Katie seemed like the kind of kid who would have enjoyed learning what else that ball toy could do, but just because her first thought was to roll it, the therapist latched onto that and shut Gemma down for even starting to show off more. Death to the therapist for thinking guardian child bonding can't involve learning. I like that.
Wow. I would never attribute like stock character status to an unkillable quality. You know, like, I mean, he is a stock character, but there's also a very singular dislike I have for him. I don't have a broad general bully.
This was about the therapist and kid. Gemma, and you're making it all about Brandon at this point. You well, understand?
Led with it.
You already
they
won. Led with... You already won. Okay.
I just wanted to rebut. Go on.
Okay. Rasheem. Brandon gets my vote simply because of his attitude and face.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
He did have have bitchy face.
And what's your Instagram handle again?
My retro bitch face, but I don't know. I just like, because he had this thing where he's just like, make her speak or talk or whatever. Yeah. It's just like, who is this shit? Like, fuck off. I hated him too. I like that he died. I just wanted the therapist to die too. Bluebox87 says, as much as I hated the therapist, I vote for Brandon. I don't care if he's a child. Some people truly deserve to be taken out of this world. Thank you, Mthrigan. I wonder if Brandon's mother should get a Mthrigan of her own now. LOL.
Ooh.
So she can help her make sandwiches or whatever they were.
So she can kill her. Yeah.
With sandwiches. Silent Saturn. I gotta be honest. I think the therapist was right to judge Gemma. She takes in her niece who just lost her parents, and first thing she does is getting all territorial. No, these are my toys. You mustn't touch them. Here, play with this murder doll instead. Why don't you? Wow.
I mean, point that out.
Wow, way to treat a heavily traumatized child, Gemma. My vote goes to Brandon, who's a little shit, though I think his mom has a lot to answer for, too.
Okay.
Jacqueline Marta. Someone who would say fuck you to their mom always gets my vote. There's no way he wouldn't end up a monster. Oh my gosh. I'm pretty sure I've like gotten into fights with my mom where like we've both sworn at each other.
Oh, I don't think I've ever said fuck you to my mother. Like, not to her face. Maybe like how as I'm say, how storming away under my breath.
Yeah.
just like, oh, fuck you. Yeah. You know, like, or, but I, you know, not to her face. No, I don't think I, that's because again, like, oh, that's aggressive. That's really, I remember.
In the context of how he said it, because it was just like, they were like, she was just being nice. Something. She was just like,
yeah, just
hey,
like, be careful or whatever she's saying. Yeah. And he's just like, fuck you.
Yeah.
She's like,
oh, that's different. Well. Like, if it was like an instigated, if there was like already like some sort of argument going on, but like he full on was just like, oh, there's my mom, like, just being a mom, like, fuck you.
Yeah.
Fuck you, Brandon.
No, it was full on, like, yeah. that Rose Byrne with her stepkids moment in Bridesmaids. Where she's just like, okay, guys, so now go have fun. She's like, you know, go fuck yourself, Helen. And they walk away. She's like, okay, yeah. someone's putting a quarter in the swear jar.
Poor Rose Byrne.
Can you stand it? Anyway, go on.
Mandejo says the amount of red flags that therapist saw, and she was just like... you'll have to work on some things, but hell no, that asshole kid has to go. Mthrigan was just doing everyone a favor, crossing you out, Brandon. Braven Burris. Braven Burris says, Brandon got what he deserved and nothing more. Also, ugh, the sister auntie not being as a choice is crazy. I'm sure we wouldn't have a movie without her moving the plot along, but at some point she had to look at herself and say, am I a bad parental figure? The therapist was not the bad guy. The sister fucked up as soon as she trusted that AI. If anyone doesn't know this yet, do not trust the AI. You never trust the AI.
I wonder if you would have chosen Gemma if you would have won. I wonder.
I don't think so. I think Brandon was made for the cherry picker.
That's true.
Literally, that's like true. Jason Blum is listening to the cherry picker, and he's just like, Zach and Eddie need to have like a yeah. really despicable character to
we need
to
a send sure to thing. The slaughter.
I will say that I think that I mean we do have confirmation. Like, we knew there was a sequel, but now we have confirmation it's going to be Mthrigan 2.0 yeah. and Allison Williams and the girl who played Katie are both coming back. So we know that our dreams are quashed of the gay storyline. But there was an SNL, which I guess that aired before, because this episode just dropped today. So I just, like, we thought of it first. We talked about it way before that aired. I just want to point
absolutely.
Out.
Absolutely. I've never wished harder that returning final girl characters would come back in the sequel and get killed in the first scene. Like, now I want it. I just want them to get killed by her.
Well, you did and then say. You did say how you I don't know if you were talking about Gemma or Katie or just like a quality of like Clear Rivers like coming back for the sequel of just like what you would
right
and I don't know if you meant like the context which one of, them. Of her
so probably Katie, but both of them, I mean, because they both experienced this evil before, so for them to kind of like be there and just kind of like no follow me kind of characters, that'd be kind of cool. But now that I know they're definitely coming back, I just want them to get killed. I want them to get Adrian King'd Friday the 13th part 2. That's what I want.
Or Rachel Carruthers Halloween 5, if you will.
Absolutely.
scissors and the first chest. Scene
first scene. I want first scene kill.
Neil Cameron. Okay, the therapist was the only one who I thought was going to for that didn't. Okay.
I don't understand.
Like, sometimes I type and I completely, like, I say the words in my head and I completely miss them. So I empathize with this. So I'm assuming was going to die. But didn't. All of her comments in the first meeting were just so stupid and judgy. She got better in the next visit, but if we only saw that first meeting, I'd say she deserved to die. However, she was nowhere near as deserving of death than Brandon. That little monster clearly knew what he was doing, and with his parent, he would simply get worse, not better, if he got to live.
Okay.
Chris Black, Brandon wasn't going to amount to much. Rob Rangel says, I haven't seen the movie, but I voted Brandon because my mom did see Mthrigan and she said Brandon deserved to die the most out of the two. I love that, like, our listeners are now just, like, asking their parents who has seen them just, like, weigh in. Who are you going to vote for in the cherry picker?
Yeah,
get your parents involved. Get your parents listening or watching. We need more voters. We need – especially if it's parents that are deciding, you know, who to kill. I like
that. They're most likely – they might not be on Instagram, but they might be on YouTube. So let them vote there, you know. Yeah. Like, let them make their vote official.
Exactly.
We encourage it.
Howell puns. Girl, please. The therapist didn't do shit to help that child. Just gentle warnings that went nowhere. I might have voted for Brandon, but the fact that she didn't die makes it worse. That's exactly how I feel. If you know, okay. The sin committed was not dying. It's like you and Ted Bowen from Friday the 13th Part 2.
Right. Yes, I understand.
Anthony DiPuzzo. Brandon, I cheered when that fucker got his ear torn off, although I feel like everyone in this movie could be up for a nomination. Gemma takes forever to sympathize with Katie dealing with her parents' death, and she literally asks for the dog to be put down before he even does anything. Not cool. Yeah, that's something we didn't mention, is that Gemma was not an animal lover. I mean, she was almost like celebrating when it's just like, good, the dog ran away.
she was pretty harsh.
Yeah. Kira Wood, I don't usually think kids deserve to die in movies other than the little shits in Halloween Kills, but Brandon deserved what he got. Those little shits did deserve to die. You know what? If M3GAN, a PG-13 movie, can kill off a kid, but Halloween Kills, an R-rated movie... I mean, I guess they killed off one of them, but I think he was like a teenager. He seemed a little older than the others.
Right.
But unless you're talking about the 1978 trick-or-treaters, they just... Death to them! They were working. Wasn't that our? That was our cherry picker. It was like the 1978.
Yeah, you picked one of the girls. You picked the aggressive girl who licked the jawbreaker.
Yeah.
In 78, and I picked.
She had bitch
the
face.
Aggressive, loud, sure. The noisy bitch face girl. In present day, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Miguelito Reyes. I hope I said that right. Brandon, technically, but fuck the therapist. My parents both work in a public school district and interact with social workers / therapists all the time. A lot of the time, they don't really have the kids' best intentions in mind. They don't care all that much about the kids. They just make decisions based on what their guidelines tell them. And those guidelines don't have the nuance or the emotional intelligence to make proper decisions in scenarios where they're needed, and families have been needlessly broken up. This therapist gave me that kind of energy. The system is very much against a lot of these kids sometimes. Hmm. Well, I always appreciate someone who has insight into the actual situation to add
absolutely.
That. So I agree with everything that you say. Matthias Egemann, the film title itself needs to die. Sounds like a name for a car. And then finally...
That's why I drive this M3GAN.
It's just like almost like the engine, like M3GAN. Starting it up, Is she going to be driving in the sequel? What? They may as well just turn it into like a Fast and Furious franchise. It's just going to be like Megan just driving and like soaring.
We're the most important thing. We're the most important thing to M3GAN is family.
Finally, Jeremiah T. The therapist died? ? No.
No. She oh my God, okay. Guys. How many times must we go over this?
You get first dibs. What shall it be?
Yay. It probably to no one's surprise if you've been listening. I think I picked the racist cop that I discussed so much before. I believe his name is Wooly, if you can, you know, confirm that before you post it.
Yeah.
But if not, just, I guess, racist cop or whatever end up finding
it's Wooly.
Out about it. But Wooly, Wooly, because also the fact that he died should satisfy me, but I almost wish he had gotten bitten just so he could die twice. I think he deserved to die again. As a human being, as a living person, and then as a living dead person, I would have really enjoyed that. So can't kill racism enough. So get rid of the reckless man with guns blazing into the homes of innocent people. Okay. Fuck him.
And I'll probably go for. I mean, like every single one of them is credited as motorcycle raider. So I'll just because he's the most prominent one, I'll go for the Tom Savini one because of just like a lack of any respect for human life or just something that, you know, just the humanity that was once there and just killing zombies for fun and encroaching on somebody's habitat and just destroying it. Yeah, just not cool energy. So there you have it. You can vote for Wooly, the racist Coppa, or Tom Savini, the motor,
the biker who committed an invasion on why am I forgetting the name? The Wes Craven movie on a with the people, the mutants who like under live the in the stairs? Mountains in the desert.
Oh, The Hills Have Eyes.
No. It was like his second movie. I remember the name? Hills Have Eyes.
Yeah.
On a Hills Have Eyes level almost of invasion. Yeah, that's what I was trying to say. Sorry. That took up a lot more time than I wanted it to.
It did. Anyway, vote your heart, vote your conscience. Poll will be on Patreon, which if you are not subscribed to our Patreon, that is a great way for you to get these episodes early. We also have our bonus Cherry Picker After Dark that comes out every month. This month, January, as this is releasing on the 31st, but it should already be out right now, is Wild Things, you know, the Nev Campbell thriller. So we talked about that. In February, we are covering Buffy the Vampire Slayer Season 4. We've already covered Seasons 1, 2, and 3, where we each ranked every episode and debated that.
Yes.
so check out my Patreon account, Zach Cherry, if you want to get in on that. You can also vote on YouTube in the community section, and you can also vote on Instagram, and the Instagram is at the Cherry Picker Pod. I did that out of order, so I'm trying to like remember what I've said or not. But I do want to welcome some new Patreon supporters. So say hello to David. It's either Madrigal or Madrigal, or probably neither of those. And I said them completely wrong. But David.
I vote Madrigal.
Madrigal. David Madrigal. Chris Beatty. Larry Kosh III, Ryan Reagan, Screamhead 571, and Liam Everett. And I also want to thank Andre Felix, our podcast editor, for continuing to edit all of our podcast episodes. So thank you to all of those people.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
I didn't
much.
Applaud adequately. Thank you. Welcome.
If you are new to the Cherry Picker and you are listening to us, the YouTube channel is there for you to watch us as well. And if you are watching us on YouTube, you can listen to us. The RSS feed link is in the descriptions down below. Where can they find you on social media?
Oh, Edward. If you go to Instagram and you search Edward is Truth, all one word, you'll find me. And if you go to YouTube and you search Edward is Truth, all one word, you should also find me. So go there. How about you, Zach Cherry?
YouTube, Zach Cherry, Z-A-C-K Cherry. And Instagram, as you already pointed out earlier, is at RetroBitchface, all one word. Twitter as well, Zach Cherry 8. But I don't know if we do you know what's going on next week?
I don't remember.
I don't know if we discussed it. It's Barbarian. We didn't. It's Barbarian.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Okay. I haven't seen it yet. I'm looking forward to it now. Okay, cool.
So this should be interesting. Fab. So thank you for watching. Thank you for listening. And we will be right back.